You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you're going to hear two interviews. The first is with best-selling Irish author Tana French, and the second with local writer Carrie McKillop, owner of the Old Brick Store in Charlotte, Vermont, and recent winner of NPR's 3-Minute Fiction Contest. Tana French grew up in Ireland, Italy, the United States, Malawi, and has lived in Dublin since 1990. She trained as a professional actress at Trinity College, Dublin, and has worked in theater, film, and voiceover. She's the author of 4 books, In the Woods, The Likeness, Faithful Place, and Broken Harbor. Her books have won Edgar, Anthony, McCavity, Barry, and ICVA Clarion Awards, and have been finalists for LA Times and Strand Magazine Awards. She lives in Dublin with her husband and daughter. During my conversation with Tana French, she mentioned that she was born right here in Burlington, which is kind of fun. She has family here. Her uncle and aunt, Doug and Marty French, own Fire and Metal Goldsmiths on Cherry Street. So that's kind of a fun fact. We spoke for about 20 minutes about her latest Dublin Murder Squad novel, Broken Harbor. I began by asking her to talk about the novel's setting, a beach town from which the book takes its title. Is Broken Harbor based on a real place, I asked, or is it more of an amalgam of other Irish coastal towns?
Yeah, it's kind of an amalgam of places. Unfortunately, it's not one real place, but unfortunately, there are any number of places in Ireland that could be Broken Harbor. It's what used to be a little seaside town where Scorcher Kennedy, the detective narrator, and his family used to come for holidays, you know, caravan holidays by the seaside. But now, like a lot of places in Ireland over kind of last 15 years, it's been taken over by a developer, and he's built this huge big estate, or has built this huge big estate, and there's a lot of this all over Ireland. There are estates like this. They were planned as these kind of idyllic luxury living places. They were sold as what was going to be these wonderful vibrant communities where you would have huge houses and happy kids playing and
right.
People chatting over picket fences. The problem is that these places should never have been built to start with. There was no need for them. And due to a combination of over-optimism and corruption, my generation, the 30-somethings, were encouraged, really pushed towards buying there. We were told, oh, you know, buy now, it'll have doubled in price in 2 years, you can sell it and move somewhere that you actually want to live.
Mm.
And then the property crash came, and the developers packed up and moved. They left these estates half-built, half-abandoned, and instead of these vibrant communities, what you've got is a few scattered families living out there, with their next-door neighbor is a house made out of scaffolding and walls.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no street lighting, there's probably no pavement, and they're stuck there in what was meant to be the dream house and has turned into the nightmare.
Right, right. And that was the scene of the murder, which is just such an incredibly potent place for this to happen. Just as a comment, I thought it was so wonderful the way the setting in this book, sort of throughout the book, but in one particular scene that I'm going to mention, the setting mirrors Scorcher's mood. So, for example, right after first seeing the crime scene, you write, "The long boom and shush of the sea rushed up and met us head on like a welcome or a challenge." I thought that was so great. So.
Thank you. Yeah, for him, this place is kind of very highly charged because he does have childhood memories. Things did not go very well for them in that play, in their last childhood holiday there. And it is by the sea, which I think is it's a powerful place for something to be,
yeah,
to be happening, especially to someone like Scorcher, who's very much all about control and order. Now, the sea is not a controlled or ordered thing. It's not something that you can fit into your neat kind of parameters. And for him, being there is something that makes him uneasy already, puts him on edge.
Mm.
And especially once you're out there in the middle of this estate, which is, you know, there are kids climbing on abandoned houses, there are acres of wasteland, there are places that, there are little tiny enclaves of families trying to make this white picket fence life that they dreamed of. It's a very strange place to be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, in the book, Scorcher Kennedy works with a new investigator named Richie Curran. And I really enjoyed that one of the ways that you have him educate Richie is by telling him about his rules of murder investigation, right? So, for example, rule number one, no emotions on scene. Rule number two, when someone's behavior is odd, that's a little present just for you. But I like the way that these rules also sort of educate the reader, and we kind of hold on to them as we go through the book and remember these rules as they become to you know, more important. So I just wonder how you came up with doing that.
Well, Scorcher Kennedy, the thing about Scorcher is he is very much all about the rules. You know?
Yeah.
For him, that is the way you have to function in life, is via rules. To me, that was actually kind of hard to write because I'm not that kind of person, and most of my friends are not that kind of person. So the idea of connecting to a character, he was like that writing for him for 2 years. I wasn't sure I wanted to write this guy for a couple of years. I wasn't sure I could ask you guys to read this guy for 200 pages. You know, kind of pompous and up himself when he shows up in the previous book, Faithful Place.
Right.
But I started thinking about what would make somebody into the kind of person who needs to live, work, love, probably, by these rules. And I was thinking, it's got to be somebody who doesn't trust his own mind, who doesn't think of his own gut as in any way a good guide. He thinks that your mind is this unreliable, shifting place that could let you down and steer you horribly wrong at any moment. So you have to have rules that will guide you when things get complicated and you don't know what to do.
Mm.
And that's how he's come up with kind of all of these rules that he sets down in stone and that he's laying out for Richie and for the reader. And I think Richie does kind of stand in the reader's place where you're going, okay, it's interesting to know that this is one way you can work an investigation, but really, can these rules really be so absolute that there is no situation where they're not a hindrance rather than a help?
Mm-hmm.
And as it turns out, even Scorcher has to acknowledge in the end that the rules, you can't always stick to the rules.
Yeah. Now, what you just said there about the two of them having different approaches, it reminds me of another question I had for you, which was in Broken Harbor, each of these characters sees the case differently, and each has his own fairly strong opinion about who committed these murders. So apart from what may or may not be the fictional truth of the plot, I'm just curious from a writing perspective, how did it serve the story for you to have two investigators who work together feeling differently about what happened?
It's kind of all about the character of Scorcher, right? His narrative arc. And he doesn't do partners, right?
Mm.
What he does is little newbies who he trains and then releases into the wild, kind mm-hmm. of like training a service dog, you know?
Right.
You work with it, but you don't expect to keep it. And for him, that's what this process is. But when he comes to Broken Harbor, because he has such strong memories himself, and because the case triggers off his mentally fragile sister who is now tugging at him, and because the case itself assaults his whole idea of cause and effect and control, he's going to be more vulnerable and he's going to need someone to work with him, someone who he can work with and not just work on, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I started thinking that Richie had to be in some ways the perfect complement to Scorcher, the perfect partner for him. And that means somebody who can do all the things that Scorcher can't.
Mm-hmm.
Scorcher, for example, cannot allow himself to empathize with anyone in a case, victim, family, suspect, no one like that. He believes that the minute you let off your control and empathize a bit, bang, things can go terribly wrong.
Mm-hmm.
There's no reasons to believe that.
Right.
So I thought he needed somebody who would be very good at empathy, very good at empathizing. In the same way, he can't go with his gut instinct at all. That's inconceivable to him. So he needed somebody who was very good at going with their gut instinct. And so Richie grew out of that because of this idea that Scorcher would, over the course of the book, find himself for the first time working with a real partner and against his will, really enjoying it because the two of them match so well right up until the moment where those two differing approaches stop being a great thing and start being a real problem.
Right. I found that really interesting. I thought that tension was great in the book. It just made it a more interesting read. So here's another thing that I think, I think this is a little bit of a courageous thing to do as a writer. You have moments within the book
And I think all of your books, probably you do this. You might have a scene where the tension is building, and then you might break away. So, for example, in this book, in between two autopsies that are taking place, you actually have your characters go outside and have a conversation that is, I guess I'd describe it as emotionally bonding. And it sort of comes into a very high-energy moment in the book. A little later in the book, at a critical moment that I'm not going to go into because I don't want to spoil anything, you have Scorcher say, "When I think about the Spain case from deep inside endless nights, this is the moment I remember. This is the one I clench tight because of how sharp it slices." So anyway, you take these moments, you ramp up the tension of these scenes and give us information at the same time. I feel like this is a little bit dangerous because you could lose the reader by breaking in at a certain point and distracting us away from the plot. So I wondered if you could speak a little bit about how you know when it's safe to break in and stretch things out a little.
See, for me, the most important plot line isn't the physical concrete one. It's a psychological one.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm interested in, is the psychological arc of this character, the narrator and the other characters, whoever they may be, and how every one of my books is about somebody who's caught in the crucial case of his career, a detective who's caught in the case that changes him, transforms him, not just as a detective, but as a person, where whatever he decides in the course of this book is going to define the rest of his life forever, basically, mm-hmm. or her life. And the plot, the physical plot, you know, who done it and where the evidence is and where that bloodstain happens to be on that wall, that is only important in terms of how it changes the characters. I'm not particularly into writing your classic whodunits. It's funny because I love reading them.
Mm-hmm.
The classic, but the butler was left-handed and the poison was in the wrong file, therefore, you know, the gardener did it. I love them. But those where the emphasis is all on physical plot and on finding out the perpetrator, I'm not interested in writing them. I'm interested in writing the ones where the real plot line is about what happens to this person's mind over the course of the book. And so because of that, I don't worry too much about occasionally breaking away from the concrete plot into the more psychological plot, because I think they only matter as they tie together.
Sure.
You know, the physical plot on its own, I know that there are a lot of crime writers out there who can plot a lot better than I can. Plotting is not particularly my strong point. So there's no point in me trying to make this all about the concrete physical plot, because there are people doing that better than I ever will. What I'm interested in is doing that link between the psychological and the physical plots. And if I don't kind of take that risk and go into the psychological plot for a bit, then there's nothing left that readers can't get much better elsewhere,
mm-hmm.
if that makes any sense.
It does. No, it does, absolutely. I keep quoting your book at you, but this is another quote from the book. Scorcher says, "If you're good at this job, and I am, then every step in a murder case moves you in one direction toward order. We get thrown shards of senseless wreckage, and we piece them together until we can lift the picture out of the darkness and hold it up to the white light of day, solid, complete, and clear." As I read that, it struck me that this is the job of the writer as well, to sort of take the chaos and bring it to order. And so I wondered if you have any advice for beginning mystery or thriller writers for keeping order and not letting the chaos of their first draft sort of overwhelm them or become problematic.
I may be in some ways the wrong person, because I tend to dive in with very little of the book sorted. I don't outline, you know, there are writers who outline, have chapter by chapter outline, they know exactly what's going to happen. I'm in awe and I'm in envy, because I start off with a narrator and a basic premise, and I just dive in and hope there's a book in there somewhere, you know, and touch wood, so far there has been, but I'm always going to worry that I'm going to hit my head on the bottom if there's no book there. I think the main thing for beginning writers, I would say, is to figure out what works for you, because you may be the type who needs everything outlined, and you may be the type who, like me, just rewrites a lot. I hate rewrites, but I do a lot of rewriting, because you have to if you're going to jump in like that, because you will hit chapter 8 and realize something that's going to make you rewrite chapters 1-7. And I think the big thing is to trust whatever turns out to work for you, and not to kind of to feel intimidated by the idea that, oh my god, so and so outlines chapter by chapter, I have to do that too, or, you know, so and so says you have to go into it spontaneously and figure it out as you go along. You have to figure out what works for you, and it may be nothing like what works for anyone else, but if it's if it's what works for you, then it's the right way.
Yeah. Each narrator of your books has been known to the reader who's read all the books in a row, because that person will have had a part in the previous book. And I was wondering, which of your four narrators, Rob, Cassie, Frank, and now Scorcher, has been the most accessible to you so far as an author?
Yeah, the easiest to write was probably Frank, because there's his faithful place, Frank Mackey.
Right.
Because he relies so much, he's very specifically Dublin. He's such a Dublin character. And he's got this Dublin sense of humor where the worse things get, the darker things get, the more you have to put a humorous spin on them. It's just automatic. And it can come across to someone who isn't a dub, it can come across as quite grim and a little gallows humory. And it can also come across as a little bit nasty sometimes, I think, to people who aren't used to that idea that the way you show affection is by slagging each other, which is kind of teasing with an edge, you know, but that's the main way people in Dublin show affection. I mean, to call somebody a you little bollocks, the state of you, that is not an insult, that's a compliment.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't sound like one from outside, but it makes things very easy to write, that fast, snappy, witty twist on things. It means that it's quite easy. It almost writes itself. On that level, I found Frank very definitely the easiest to write.
Oh, okay.
But I think the one I'd prefer to go for a pint with is Cassie.
Yeah.
Not Frank.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, so, I mean, and you've mentioned that Scorcher's a rule follower, so it must be a little bit harder to, you know, just sort of, like, live in his head for a while if it's not who you are.
Yeah, it is. It is. He's not my type of guy. He's not the kind of guy I hang out with or anything like that. But one of the joys of doing this chain-linked book thing, right, is that you get to show how nobody knows anybody else inside out.
Mm-hmm.
Like in Faithful Place, Scorcher shows up. He's Frank Mackey's kind of old friend, old enemy, old annoyance, and he's the guy investigating the case. And he's portrayed as this really pompous, rule-bound, uptight git.
Right.
But that's kind of partly because that's what Frank needs to see. Frank has just found out that his first love didn't leave him after all. She was murdered. And he is looking desperately for something to fight, for an enemy. And until he finds the killer to take this out on, Scorcher will just have to do. So he is seeing Scorcher through absolute fury in many ways. He's not objective. And so in Broken Harbor, I kind of needed to explore what really made Scorcher like this. Is he just a pompous git because he's like that? And the thing is that nobody is. Nobody thinks that they are a pompous, boring git.
Mm-hmm.
They always have good reasons. And it's my job to see it from that character's perspective and give his reasons, give his argument, whether or not I agree with it. And that's when I started to realize that Scorcher does, in fact, have very good reasons for sticking to the rules. And that made it easier to write.
Yeah, because you figured him out.
Yeah.
I loved that he and Frank each think that his nickname came from a different place. I thought that said such a great thing about each of their characters.
Oh, you got that. I'm so glad. I didn't know if anyone was going to pick up on that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that was wonderful, because Frank totally thinks he gave him the nickname, and Scorcher has a completely different background to it, so I don't know.
Yeah, they both remember what they need to remember, what fits their idea of themselves in the relationship.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for making time this morning.
Thank you so much for having me on. And yeah, say hi to Burlington.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Tana French. I don't know if you caught that last little remark, say hi to Burlington. But if you didn't hear the beginning of the show, Tana French was born in Burlington. You can learn more about her work at her website, tanafrench.com. So today's second interview is with a local writer who has written for many years, but has only just recently begun to send out her work, and it was sort of by accident, but you'll hear all about that. Carrie McKillop owns the Old Brick Store in Charlotte. Although she has no formal background in creative writing, she holds a bachelor's degree in English from the University of California at Los Angeles, and she's spent many years working on her craft. As you'll hear in our interview, she found herself inspired by a recent National Public Radio 3-minute fiction prompt and decided to write and submit a short story to the contest. And then she won. We talked by phone about what this experience was like for her. When we spoke, Carrie was at the Charlotte Beach enjoying a respite at the end of a very busy day at the store. And I personally enjoyed hearing the sounds of children playing on the beach as we talked about her story, Rainy Wedding, which has a lot to do with children, actually, and their well-being. I began the interview by asking Carrie to talk a little bit about her work owning a business and also her work as a writer.
Well, I own a country store in Charlotte, Vermont. And prior to that, I co-owned Muddy Waters in Burlington.
Oh.
A little coffee house down Main Street with my ex-husband. And I bought the Old Brick Store in 2009 and have been running that ever since.
And you bought the Old Brick Store. Had it had another owner in between two? I'm not asking this very well, but the Old Brick Store was owned by people for a really long time, right? And then somebody owned it for a couple of years, and then you bought it. Is that correct?
Right, right. So there was it sort of did a little thing. Two couples bought it, and then they ended up. One of the couples bought the other couple out, and then they had it for about 15 years, and they kind of brought it to its really great heyday of being this kind of cool European market. They really kind of, you know, bumped it up from what it had been, which was sort of your, you know, your just kind of country convenience store.
Mm-hmm.
And then they sold it to a woman who ended up very tragically passing away within a couple weeks after buying the store.
Oh, no, I
and
didn't
her,
know that.
Yeah, it was really, really sad. And her children inherited it, and they were all pretty young, you know, 22, like 19 and 18 or something.
Mm-hmm.
And they made a really good go of really trying to sort of see their mother's vision out, which, you know, she had this, she was a charlotter, and she had this vision of this kind of cool pizza place store. And so they tried really hard, but they were really young, and they had two other restaurants that their parents owned that they were trying to run, and
oh,
and it, you know, it just sort of got away from them. And so then I bought it, kind of, I think at really its sort of lowest point.
Mm. Okay. Yeah. Well, it's wonderful now. I love going in there. It's such a great location. It's such a great spot for bikers. How about your writing background? When did you start writing?
You know, sort of going back to, I guess, you know, when I started was, I can remember the first story I wrote in the second grade, and then wrote a lot of short stories and was fairly active just in my own personal stuff until probably about 10 years ago when my third child was born. And then I basically stopped altogether, and I haven't written anything in years. And in fact, when I won the NPR contest, my partner, who I've been with for 4 years, you know, was completely shocked. I hadn't even given him the story. And I told him I had entered this contest, and he kind of like, "You write? You're a writer?" And so it was really something that I hadn't done in a really long time, which is why this came as a real shock.
Oh, that's so funny. Now, so why did you decide to submit to the contest, to the NPR 3-Minute Fiction Contest?
Well, it was total luck. I had decided, you know, because I own the store, to randomly close early one Sunday. We normally close at 6, and I decided to close at 5 because I was just tired and cranky, and it was one of those days. And so we decided to close at 5, hopped in the car, and I heard All Things Considered, the weekend edition, which I never hear because I'm always working. And as I was driving home, they announced that it was the last day for submission for this prompt. And they read the prompt, and I just on my 3-minute drive home, I thought, oh, well, I could do something with that. And I got home, and as it so happened, no one was there. None of the three kids were there, and the house was empty. And so I just had this idea and banged it out and submitted it, and then actually completely forgot about it until they called me to tell me that I'd won.
Oh, my gosh. So you wrote it that same day and finished it and sent it in that same day?
Yeah.
That's amazing. So the prompt that they assigned was the sentence, "She closed the book, placed it on the table, and finally decided to walk through the door." So I wonder if you can describe what happens in the story, and then we'll talk a little bit about it.
Sure. Well, I'll just explain how it came to be, which was, you know, when they read the prompt, it was very, there was this real sense of foreboding.
Mm-hmm.
With what was on the other side of the door. And as a mom, I think the easiest thing for me to imagine as something really horrible on the other side was your own sick child and sort of having to face that reality. And so then I had the vision of this small boy who's dying on the other side. And, you know, in the backstory, which you don't get any of this, which I very purposely, because there was only 600 words to work with, I don't diagnose him. None of the characters have names. It's all just a very, very emotional piece. And so the mom goes through the door, and she her 5-year-old son, who's dying, you know, greets her with, "Today I get married," right? And she, over the course of his illness, she's been sort of living his life for him and telling him all the things that he would be doing as he's growing up, because she knows that he is dying. And so it starts when he wants to know what kindergarten is going to be like, because he won't be able to go. And so she describes kindergarten, and then she describes all through school and high school and college, and he meets his fiance. And so this, the particular story that she's telling him on this day is the story of their wedding day.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Which is a disaster because it's pouring rain, and there's sort of this tenet, this underlying theme of her stories, which, because, you know, I intimately know these characters at this point, is that, you know, she always tells him these stories where things always go wrong, but everything turns out okay. And the concept or the idea is that, you know, life throws us wrenches, and we have to test them.
Yeah. Okay. I thought it was a great story. You didn't take a long time at all to tell the reader that the child is sick. It's in the second sentence. Your second sentence begins, "Her son lay dying." So, you know, it says that she finally decided to walk through the door, and then her son lay dying on the other side, basically, is what that sentence goes on to say. And I was thinking that it might have been a temptation to make the reader figure out what was going on in a longer story. And I'm just wondering if you have any recollection of making the decision to put that right up front.
Well, I think that in a story, I've never written anything this short before. You know, flash fiction is not something I wasn't even familiar with the term, until after, I wrote the story and then got some, you know, some flash fiction, workshops and things, have asked me to come and read.
That's great.
And I think that, it was really just, you know, it's really pared down. It's a very, very simple story. There's really very few extra words.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, when I was dealing with that 3-minute or that 600-word constriction, that it basically everything that was important had to be there really, really quickly. And things that weren't important just weren't there at all.
Right. Right. Like you said, like their names and things that wouldn't change how we feel about them necessarily.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it was the son dying on the other side of the door was the thing that hit me immediately. So, you know, it sort of had to hit the reader immediately as well.
Right. I loved the fact that as the story progresses, the description of the mother telling the boy about his life changes from sounding like storytelling to sounding like an actual recounting of some things that happen in real life. So, for example, the sentence where he meets his fiance is, "He met his fiance when she lost her purse on a rainy day while he was at a meeting in Manhattan." And she tells this sentence as though it's a real thing instead of as though it's a story.
Right. Well, I feel like I wanted to leave a lot to the reader's imagination, and actually reading, I've read the story and heard the story a bunch of times at this point, and that sentence really always strikes me because of how little that's in it, but you as the reader can fill in all those blanks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so I think when I was writing it, it all made sense to me. I saw the whole thing happen. I saw the pouring rain and them on the street corner, and she drops her purse and he sees that she drops it and he picks it up and hands it to her, and, you know, and they kind of have this minute where they, you know, go for coffee or whatever. But none of that happens.
not written down on the page, but it does happen in a way. Well, it's funny because that's exactly how I pictured it too, although the words aren't there, so that's great. Now, are your kids old enough to have read the story and had some sort of reaction to it?
Yes. Well, the wedding is my daughter's wedding. It was her wedding last spring.
And
all those things actually happened. And there were some things that were so ridiculous that happened in her wedding that I didn't put in, like the tornado hitting the tent and, you know, all of it. I mean, it was so ridiculous.
oh, my God.
But it was such a beautiful event. And so, you know, all those things were real, which is probably, you know, part of what makes the story as good as it is, because it was all very close to my heart. So, yeah, my kids have all read it. They all love it. They're all waiting for the book to come out.
Or the other ones are waiting for stories about them, probably.
Right.
Well, it's a great story, and I will put a link to the NPR website so people can go and read it. Before we finish, I just have a couple more questions. I was wondering, who are a couple of your favorite authors or books that you have read recently?
Well, I hadn't heard of Luis Alberto Urrea before the contest.
Uh-huh.
And he has since become, he and his family have become friends of mine. He was the judge of the contest.
Right.
And he sent me his book, The Hummingbird's Daughter, and then I've picked up a few of his other books, and he's actually, you know, just, he's a fabulous, fabulous author, and he can write a paragraph in which, you know, there is drama and comedy and intensity and levity and, you know, all of these things all at once. And he's really pretty much blowing me away right now. And he's also a really fascinating character.
Oh.
So I'm loving him.
That's wonderful. That's great. It's so nice that you discovered him after he chose your story, so you could sort of experience the excitement of having him like your story after you've learned who he is and read his work.
Yeah. It's been a really fun relationship, and you know, I think we definitely have a little mutual respect thing going on, and it's fun getting to know him through his writing as well, because his personality really comes through with all of his stuff.
Oh, that's great.
He's got a great family. He's got a very supportive wife and three great kids, and so it's definitely really cool.
Yeah. Okay. Now, the way you said his name was so just perfect. Do you speak Spanish?
I grew up in Southern California. I took Spanish for many years, and I have a lot of Spanish-speaking people in my family, so my Spanish is not very good, but...
Okay.
I do know some things, and I actually have a little shack in Costa Rica, so I get exposed to it down there.
Oh, okay. All right,
my
great.
Spanish should be better than it is.
Well, it sounded pretty good just there. So I was going to say, I don't know if you've read, have you read Julia Alvarez's work?
Yeah, definitely.
She was on the show, and she's actually the person who emailed me and said, the 3-minute fiction contest was won by somebody local. You should totally talk to her. So I just want to say that Julia Alvarez.
Yeah, I love her book. She's a fantastic writer.
Yeah.
I've loved everything of hers that I've read, and Luis is similar to her. You know, they both have that very challenging immigrant perspective of people coming in and the way that they're looked at. It's so hard, and the revolutionary thing as well. I mean, mm-hmm. it's a thing that we just really don't have and can't really understand, but it's so emotional and really impressive. There's strength there that's really cool.
Yeah. All right. Well, so, Carrie, I wanted to ask, have you sent work to other contests either before or since this one?
No. I have a lot of agents that are very interested in representing me.
Oh, that's awesome.
I have a really big group that is sort of hounding me, and a couple of other kind of cool women in smaller outfits. But they really just want more. They want to see more, and I have a little bit, but
yeah.
haven't had enough time to really give them what they're looking for.
Oh, that's pretty exciting. So, yeah, you gotta hire a new manager for the store and stay home and
exactly.
write.
Well, you know, it was the cutest thing, because when the story aired, the number of people that emailed me to say that they would be more than happy to volunteer in the store so that I didn't have to work, because clearly I needed to just be home writing.
No,
it was so sweet and touching. It was really, really cool.
That is really cool. Okay, so you've had this one experience of sending something into a contest and then you won, which is awesome. So do you have any advice for writers who are considering whether or not to send their work to contests?
My only advice would be to write as if no one's going to read it.
Okay.
And when I wrote this story, I honestly didn't think that anyone would read it. When I submitted my story, they said... We have already had over 6,000 submissions.
Oh.
So I didn't think a human being would actually ever read it, and nobody read it until Susan Gamberg read it online, you know, from anyone that I knew. So I think that given that sort of abandon that I had of not being afraid of what other people would think of it, made it what it was. Okay. And so, you know, it's that old adage, you know, you just write what you want and write from the heart, and, you know, just go for it.
That's great.
Don't beat around the bush.
Wonderful. Perfect advice. Excellent. Well, Carrie McKillop, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you. It was really fun.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Carrie McKillop. You can learn more about her work at a few different websites. Her story, Rainy Wedding, can be found at npr.org. And once you get there, you have to search for the 3-Minute Fiction page on the website, and that'll get you there. She's the most recent winner of that contest. I'll put a link on the podcast site to her actual story. The Old Brick Store's website is oldbrickstore.com. And then finally, Carrie has started a blog on Tumblr, which you can find at carriemckillop.tumblr.com. Carrie is spelled C-A-R-R-I-E. McKillop is M-A-C-K-I-L-L-O-P. And there is no E in Tumblr. Write the Book is brought to you in part by Main Street Landing, creating places for people to work, play, entertain, meet, eat, and greet on Burlington's waterfront. Main Street Landing rents office and retail space, as well as daily rentals for meetings, events, and performances in their Performing Arts Center. More information is available from Melinda at 802-864-7999 or mainstreetlanding.com. And by Clean Green Sanitation, providing local earth-friendly sanitation services with strong concern for the environment. More information at 802-658-8600 or cleangreen-vt.com. Clean Green Sanitation, keeping it local and keeping it green. And by VCAM, with a mission to enrich civil discourse in the Chittenden County region by providing local citizens with access to training and state-of-the-art digital media tools as a means of personal, political, and artistic self-expression. More information at vermontcam.org. And then by the Lake Champlain Land Trust, a nonprofit organization permanently conserving the lands, lakeshore, critical wildlife habitats, and natural areas of Lake Champlain. More information online at lclt.org. Here's the Bookworm's calendar for the week. Vermont author and former 2-time Write the Book guest Chris Bojalian will be reading from his new book, The Sandcastle Girls, on Tuesday, August 7th at 7 at Bear Pond Books in Montpelier. Bear Pond's Not Just Fiction Book Club's next meeting is then at Bear Pond Books on Wednesday, August 8th at 7. The book for discussion at this meeting will be The Hare with Amber Eyes by Edmund DeWall. Phoenix Books in Burlington hosts an appearance by author Joshua Masters, whose latest book is American Psalms. Thursday, August 9th at 7, he will be at Phoenix Books in Burlington. The Northshire Bookstore in Manchester Center hosts a double reading with Jesse Haas, author of Bramble and Maggie, Horse Meets Girl, and Michael J. Daly, author of Pinch and Dash Make Soup. Saturday, August 11th at 4. The Northshire will then hold a summer art camp with the Vermont Arts Exchange Tuesday, August 14th and Wednesday, August 15th, during which the art bus from Vermont Art Exchange will visit the Northshire Bookstore to offer artists ages 8 to 12 classes in sculpture, drawing from nature and townscapes, creative book sculpture, and storytelling through cartooning. More information at 802-362-2200 or northshire.com. Today's Write the Book prompt was suggested by my second guest, Carrie McKillop. Write a story of 600 words in which a parent confesses something to a child. Carrie offered an opening line as well. Tess was drowning in inefficiency. So you could use that in conjunction with her first prompt, or you could use it on its own as a first line, just as NPR's first line inspired Carrie to write Rainy Wedding. Good luck with these prompts, and tune in next week for another
Write the Book has a Facebook page. If you are a Facebook user, please like us. And if you're interested in sharing the show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. If you have comments about the show or news about book-related events, if you have a writing prompt to suggest, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Please remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator and volunteer opportunities is always available online at theradiator.org. We're finishing up a little early today, so I'm going to just navigate over to the weather page and give you a weather forecast if I can here. So this afternoon, mostly sunny with a high near 80, northwest winds around 8 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly clear with a low around 53. Northwest wind 5 to 8 miles an hour, becoming southwest after midnight. Tuesday, sunny with a high near 83. South wind 8 to 10. Tuesday night, partly cloudy with a low around 57. South wind around 7 miles an hour. And then Wednesday, mostly sunny with a high near 85 and a south wind 7 to 9 miles an hour. And that's thanks to the National Weather Service, we can offer you that report. So this has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont.